Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University College of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences, Sargent College. Our speaker is University of Chicago Professor of Surgery, Dr. Dana Suskind. Dr. Suskind's lecture is titled 30 Million Words, A Public Health Approach to Early Childhood Education. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Christopher Moore, Dean of Boston University's Sargent College.
Dana Suskind, MD, Professor of Surgery and Pediatrics at the University of Chicago, is a pediatric otolaryngologist and founder and director of the 30 Million Words Project. She's the author of her 2015 book, 30 Million Words, Building a Child's Brain. Dr. Suskind's work has been attracting the world's attention for quite some time. Her work has been covered by The Washington Post, National Public Radio, USA Today, Freakonomics, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and many other prominent outlets. What makes her research so compelling, as is true for many of the most compelling ideas we encounter, is how such disparate fields as data science, public health, developmental psychology, neuroscience, speech pathology, auditory neuroscience, and on converge to provide a clear behavioral path to better health. And where scientists appreciate these subtle distinctions among interpretations, new parents and caregivers deeply appreciate clarity. Baby sleeps on her back. Thankfully for the new parents in the audience, I don't think that today's lecture will feature a lot of on the one hand this and on the other hand that. The elegance and brilliance of Dr. Suskind's work is her multidisciplinary approach. Her work with implantation of cochlear prosthetics led her to consider language development from the perspective of an epidemiologist, revealing early disparities that have pervasive lifelong effects. I'm so energized and excited by this work. I need to stop before I try to give Dr. Suskind's talk for her. I'll just say that we're in for a rare treat, seeing how the work of a single lab can work from detection and description of a public health threat through concrete recommendations for making a lifelong difference in the lives of so many. So please join me in warmly welcoming Dr. Dana L. Suskind.
It is incredibly hard to follow that. So I think I'll just end here. Thank you. So I want to thank you all for inviting me. It's a pleasure. And it's such an easy flight from Chicago. I will come again and again. So the concept of prevention lies at the heart of what we're trying to advance at TMW. That is a public health approach to early learning to help impact the educational gap between rich and poor children. But to do this, what we really need to do is reimagine the early childhood landscape so that it is better aligned with the powerful brain science that we are all now knowing. The powerful brain science that's showing us that learning doesn't start on the first day of school, but rather the first day of life. And that it's not in the schoolhouses in which the foundations for learning are built, but rather the homes and the communities in which we are, which our children live. We need an educational approach that really reflects that reality, one that I like to call takes a public health approach to early learning, that looks for impact at scale, and most importantly, puts those who science has clearly shown are the critical architects of our young children's brains at the center of it. Parents and caregivers, and the power of their language and interaction. So I'm going to start off with my own story, not so much that I really want to talk about myself, but I think my story helps explain how it was that I got to this point, because as your wonderful dean mentioned, I am a cochlear implant surgeon. And let's face it, cochlear implant surgeons, actually any surgeon, is known for many things. Talk is not one of them. So we will start off with my story, because I think it can make clear why it is that I am working in this world. So approximately 10 years ago, I started the pediatric cochlear implant program at the University of Chicago. And as many of you all know, a cochlear implant allows a child born deaf the ability to hear and to talk, and often to mainstream educationally. But it wasn't long before I realized that the miraculous potential of a cochlear implant came with a very large asterisk. And what I discovered completely changed the course of my career. And I want to make very clear, as I talk about the power of language, for to be inclusive of everyone in this audience, language includes spoken, sign language. It is the power of language that builds a child's brain. So with that, I started the implant program with great excitement and started seeing all these wonderful children, all who looked as if they had the same potentials for learning how to talk and learn. But I soon noticed an unsettling difference among them after implantation. Some of them would be talking and learning on par with their hearing peers, and others, same time out, would barely be able to communicate. It was a very painful difference to see. And I quickly began to realize what that asterisk indicated. That while the cochlear implant brought sound to a child's brain, something else was needed to make those sounds have meaning. And so began my journey where I tried to understand why this was, and more importantly, what I could do about it. And so along the path, I'm at the University of Chicago, the land of many wonderful researchers, as here at BU. I actually, believe it or not, audited a child development class. I won't tell you how old I was, but let's just say it was a learning experience. I'm glad I was auditing it. But one of the first studies that I came about was by researchers Betty Hart and Todd Risley. And their study really helped me to understand that the differences that I was seeing amongst my patients after implantation had little to do with their underlying deafness, but rather the world in which they had been born. Their study helped me to understand that the power of early language environments were critical for children's early educational experience and ultimate academic trajectory. Their study, and this is just a graph from their study, basically, it was a pretty small study. They followed about 40 or so families in Kansas City over a period of time, and they went into their homes and recorded. And what they found after they extrapolated was quite impressive. What they found was that children from lower income backgrounds often heard, again, extrapolated, what they called 30 million words less than their more affluent peers. Now, everybody gets sort of stuck on this big number, and it's what gets people's attention, and we have to understand that. But in truth, Hart and Risley found much, much more. They found huge qualitative differences, with children from lower language environments hearing many less conversations, many more prohibitions and less affirmations, don't do that, sit down, less complex vocabulary, often called the word gap or the 30 million word gap. These differences, how many words and how much language a child heard, were critical factors, not just in vocabulary development, but importantly in IQ and test score in the third grade. But what's really important about this study and a myriad of studies that have followed is that while at first glance it sounds like, well, it's all about socioeconomic status, in truth, after careful analysis, the critical factor appears to be early language environments. And in truth, Hart and Risley gets all the attention, and they do have a big number, so that's really great. But in truth, it's only the first sentence in a rich, rich research strain that shows the critical impact of early language environments in a child's ability to learn and communicate. In fact, parent talk has been connected to the literacy development, math and spatial reasoning, executive function, socio-emotional development. In fact, it builds the whole child. It builds the whole brain. And in truth, I'm not a big lover of the term the 30 million word gap, even though everybody seems to connect me with it. In truth, I much rather the power of parent talk. And interestingly, the book that I wrote, I so desperately wanted that as the byline, but my editor wouldn't let me. So it is all about the power of parent talk. And why is this? In truth, it all comes down to the brain. And this is the intersection of child development and neuroscience, which is so incredibly exciting. Because when all of us are born, most of our organs are fully formed. Our heart, our lungs, our kidneys, they function from day one as they will for their entire lives. But not our brains. Our brains come out pretty underdeveloped, absolutely dependent on what it encounters on its ride to full development. And during those first 3 years, there's a huge amount of development. Some 80 to 85% of the physical brain will be grown during that period of time. And in truth, there's a burgeoning neuroscience demonstrating the impact of socioeconomic status on the developing brain. Unfortunately, too often in those areas that are so important for academic learning, the prefrontal cortex, which is executive function, the hippocampus, the temporal regions, which are important for language. On the positive side, some wonderful new neuroscience research, which actually we have an author in the audience, has really beautifully started to connect what we know in the early child development literature and the neuroscience and bringing it together. And Dr. Romeo et al. Recently published a beautiful article connecting how many conversations a child heard in their home. They could connect it, correlate it to Broca's area, which is important for language, and then child outcomes. So really that through line between exposure to brain to outcomes. And in truth, there are many environmental impacts on the developing child. This is a schematic by Kim Noble, who really traces out those important aspects of socioeconomic status which can impact the developing brain. There, as you can see on the top, there's the impacts of early linguistic environments, which is really my focus, as well as family stress. And there's a lot of discussion now in the health literature on toxic stress. And these are the two main environmental impacts that impact a child's ability to reach their potential. We are all absolutely born with our genetic potential. But anybody who would deny the fact that your architectural plans are pretty meaningless without quality contractors and quality materials has never built a house. So with that, that's the background. What are we doing at the University of Chicago? It is a translational research program. For whatever reason, people often think that I am an on-the-ground, not-for-profit impacting families on our own. In fact, there are many incredible people who are doing that. My role is actually as a researcher, trying to develop evidence-based programs that work with those who are most important for children's brain growth, parents and caregivers. We develop evidence-based programs during the first 3 years of life that really take a population-level view, and I'll explain a little bit more, and that puts prevention at the forefront. Before I go on, though, I'd like to say two really important things that I will never forget to say. Number one, while we've talked about language, socioeconomic status, and lagging achievement, it's critically important to remember that no socioeconomic group has cornered the market on loving their children nor wanting their children to be happy and successful. With that, we have to acknowledge another important truth, something that I see firsthand every day working with the incredible families across the Chicagoland. To say that being poor is difficult would be the greatest of understatements. There are many impinging factors on a home language environment. Families living in poverty, without stable childcare, without stable housing, without stable sources of income, must be supported. This science is not simply about telling people, hey, go talk to your kid. This science is about why we need social policies which invest in families and communities so that they can invest in their children. With that, what are we doing? What I'd like to now describe is really the overarching model that we're taking at TMW, what I like to call as a public health approach to early learning. There are no silver bullets out there. Aspiring to a population level shift is akin to, going to the moon. I guess we can go to the moon. But what the way we've approached it is this: to really impact something as difficult to impact as it is, as is language, behavior, and interaction with one child, and the scale that we need to take, we really need to take a population level view. And with that, we're developing a model that is a multiple touchpoint approach that meets families where they are during the first 3 years of life, starting at the prenatal or perinatal period, maternity wards, going into pediatricians' offices, home visits and community-based centers, and interacting and obviously pulling in the early learning component. While there's much, when people talk about the early childhood landscape, they often talk about preschool for all, which is critically important, as well as home visiting. But I think we need to expand our vernacular for understanding what the early learning landscape could look like. And this is just one model. I'm hoping that many, many people are developing their own models for putting parents and caregivers at their center. So we have interventions that go across this whole landscape. While I can't go into depth about each of these interventions, the basic idea is this. Our interventions aim to impact knowledge, beliefs, and ultimately behaviors. As we all know from the fact that I don't exercise every day and I eat a lot of junk food, impacting health behaviors is not easy. Impacting language behaviors is not easy. It is probably the hardest thing that you could imagine. So for that reason, you can't expect education to be the end-all and be-all. You really need to think strategically about how you can impact behaviors. And towards that end, we systematically incorporate, and this is borrowed from the econ world, behavioral nudges. I never knew that until I became related to an economist. But we've embedded behavioral nudges into all of our programs, trying to translate knowledge into action. And this is just a figure describing the different nudges that we have. I'll just describe one of them that we're most associated with, that of using the LENA for linguistic feedback. How many of you all have heard of the LENA? A few? Yeah. So basically what it is it's like a small language pedometer or Fitbit. It basically records the language environment of a child, where you can see the number of adult words, conversational turns, child vocalizations. You can do more with it, but we basically use it in the grossest of terms as an opportunity for goal setting and as well as feedback. There are other technologies that are coming down the pike. I keep waiting for somebody to develop an app, which would be really easy to use. Anyway, so this is just an example of how we use the LENA in our home visiting program. You can see this is a chart that we create looking at the turns per hour. We give feedback both on adult words as well as conversational turns. And in truth, what we found, and this is really good because of what the research shows, it's much easier to impact conversational turns than adult words, because it's not so much that adult words aren't important, but I think the way the LENA records it, you can go to the laundromat and see 45,000 adult words, and they're really pretty meaningless. Whereas when you have a conversational turn with the LENA, you know it's an interaction between parent and child. So anyway, so what we do is, in our home visiting program, each week the family goal sets as to how many words and how many turns that they hope to have with their child. And they goal set. And you can see each week they have, how they do. And they assess and try to do better or congratulate themselves. So this is the focus of our program. The idea that you need behavioral nudges. The three T's are a critical factor in our program, but you'll see all of that. So I'm going to give you a high-level view of some of the different programs and then go into some of the research findings that we have. So we start off with the lowest dosage intervention, the newborn, that's overlaid onto the universal newborn hearing screen. And why do we do the newborn hearing screen? It's not simply to detect hearing loss. It's because language, both oral and sign, are the food for the developing brain. And towards that end, we think this is a really important opportunity to share this message at a large scale. We recently finished a randomized control trial with approximately 500 families. And I will show you a small snippet from the newborn.
Think of your baby's brain like a piggy bank. Every word you say is another coin in his bank. The more you talk, the richer his brain gets. The more you put in now, the richer he'll be later. Your day is full of opportunities to talk more if you talk about what you're doing as you're doing it. Don't just change your baby's diaper. Don't just wipe your baby's face. Don't just do it. Talk your baby through it.
Mommy's putting your leg in, okay? And you're going to put your other leg in. Now mommy's going to zip that baby up so that baby can stay warm. She can stay warm, warm, warm.
And I want to apologize. We actually have it captioned, so please forgive me. So what happens next? Well, not all children go into childcare. Almost all see their pediatrician. And towards that end, we view the healthcare sector as a critically important part of our model. We've developed a four-part intervention that works through the well baby visits of 1, 2, 4, and 6 months. And all of our programs are both in English and Spanish. And I'm going to show you a small snippet of a program that's in the midst of an RCT with 500 families.
Gilly. Can I get a smell? Thank you.
Yeah? You promise you'll sleep tonight? You will? All right.
Oh, big yawn.
Every day is something new.
You have a great day and you think you know how to do everything. You think, I am the best mother in the world. And then there's some days where she just can't seem to get comfortable, can't seem to be fed enough, it seems like, or can't seem to sleep enough.
I realized that, well, I just need to have a lot of patience, and every stage is different.
I feel like I'm getting to know her better every day, every moment.
There go the good stuff.
That was your hungry cry. I know your hungry cry. I was on it.
So the first two interventions that I mentioned, the newborn and the well baby, are relatively light dosages that are meant to be able to scale to a large numbers in a sort of cost-effective way. We have a higher dosage intervention, our home visiting program, that is much more intensive, so to speak. And it's over 6 months meeting with families in the home with a home visitor one-on-one. It's modeled actually after early intervention that we often work with families with after cochlear implantation. And it's actually our most developed of interventions. We're in the midst of a longitudinal study, meaning we're following families with children about 13 to 15 months until kindergarten. And later on, I'm going to show you some of the data, but I'd like to just show you a small snippet of this. Because what I found most phenomenal as I really learned about this literature and the science is that language builds so much more than just vocabulary. It builds abilities such as math and spatial skills. And towards that end, we share this information with families. And families actually find the math and spatial information incredibly sticky, and we've seen fairly large results with it. So I'm going to show you a small snippet of our math and spatial.
Talking about shapes helps build your child's math foundation. There are shapes everywhere. Tune into what your child is focused on and talk more and take turns about its shape.
Do you want to empty out your box so you can sit in it?
Whoopsie. What do you want? You want the bowl?
La 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 la.
Yeah. Put your remote in the green rectangle. Yeah. That book is a rectangle shape too, just like this box.
Whoa, what is that? What is that? A circle like a ball. Whoa, it's like a ball. Look, it's like a circle.
Look, I see rectangles on the window. Okay. I see those. And then look, you see those things on top of the roof?
Yeah, I get circles.
Yep, exactly. Those are circles. I think I see a triangle.
Thank you.
Yeah, don't that bush look like a triangle?
Yeah.
It does. This is a triangle, right?
Come on. This triangle is more.
You gonna show me more? What you gonna show me?
All right. So last little video that I'm going to show you is actually in Spanish. And the beauty of, I think, this little snippet is that you don't need to know Spanish to know what's going on. We've culturally adapted and translated all of our programs into Spanish, and we're in the midst of an RC, a randomized control trial, as well with our Spanish home visiting program. So we often explain behaviors in both the positives and the negatives, and we start off with the negative initially. So. All right, so you can imagine it was about technology.
Le ponemos, le hacemos una casita al guau, al perrito. Ok, aquí está la casita. Corre. Casita, casita. Vamos en la casita. Casita,
casita, casita, casita, casita.
So that's just, these are just little snippets. We have a program, and I won't show you, that we're developing for early child care educators, not so much as professional development, but really so that they can have a shared language to share this information both with the parents of the children they're taking care of, and even hopefully to impact their interaction. And we're currently adapting into group sessions as well. So as exciting and as compelling as this program can seem, I always say it's pretty meaningless unless you can demonstrate the impact on the developing child. And that's why, for me, science is such a critical component. Science, for me, is a tool for social change, for understanding what works, and more importantly, what doesn't work, and how you can make it better. This schematic just really reflects the approach that we take in the lab for the developing of our programs, the iterating of our programs, and the cycle that it takes. And I'll share a little bit of the science that we have going on. As I mentioned, our most developed intervention is our home visiting intervention. We're in the midst of a longitudinal study following children for about 5 years. They're all English-speaking across the Chicagoland, and all families are 200% or below the poverty line. The nice thing is that the control group actually gets an intervention. They get a program learning about nutrition. So I always say we're going to have one group that's super smart and then one group who's super fit. So what does this the study timeline look like? I always say that it's sort of like thinking about a longitudinal randomized control trial is sort of like having a child. It sounds really exciting, and then you say, oh my gosh, this is a lot of work. But it's very exciting. That was a very bad joke, sorry. So this is the study timeline of our program. As you can see, in the beginning, we get baselines on all the families. Can you hear me? And then it's a pretty short period of time that we intervene and work with families in the home, only about 6 months. There's a supplemental intervention, but the majority of the time is really following the families, collecting the data. And we're still very much in the beginnings of, I guess a little bit beyond the beginnings of data collection. So I'll share with you what we're finding. So while we fully recruited, most have not gone through a lot of it. As you can see, the average age is about 28, 29. They're primarily English-speaking African-American families around Chicago. About 60% have high school or some GED, and their children are about a year and 2 months or so. So what are some of the ways that we're looking, what are some of the measures that we're looking at? In the theory of change, to be able to impact child outcomes, you first have to be able to demonstrate impacts on families, both their knowledge and how they interact with their children. So one of the first things that we're looking at is the impact on maternal beliefs, knowledge and beliefs. Because to really expend the time, you want families to not only understand it, but truly believe that they can make a difference. I think we often skip over this idea that you may love your children, but if you don't realize how important it is to invest in this way, you won't necessarily do it. Towards that end, we've been developing in our lab a tool that we call the Speak, which we've been in the midst of validating that anybody is welcome to use. It's the parent or provider knowledge and beliefs about young children's cognitive and language development. And you can see some of the examples. Infants learn little about language in the first 6 months of life. And we know that's not true. Or responding to infants every time they cry will end up spoiling them. So what did we find? And again, you can see that later on, you can see baseline, post-intervention in 6 months. You can see the numbers are getting smaller. It's not because people are dropping out. It's because they haven't gotten to that point. I mean, we have dropouts, but not that significant. So you can see the orange are control group, and they're pretty stable. What I find interesting in all of our studies that we've been collecting, just by having a kid doesn't mean that you're gaining knowledge from the outside world about child development, which is interesting in and of itself. In our experimental group, or the families getting the TMW intervention, you can see significant increases in post-intervention and 6 months post-intervention. So we're impacting their knowledge, and it seems to be sticking. So that's a good thing. Now, how about behaviors, how they interact with families? And for any of you all who do this type of research, you know one of the measures we collect are videos, and we code them and we transcribe them. And anybody who does this work knows that not only is it super expensive, it takes a really long time. So I'm going to share with you what we're getting, what we've gotten so far. So one of the coding schemes that we used on our videos is called the Parcheesi, and it's really looking at behaviors with the child during free play, both positive and negative behaviors. And obviously, because even though we're called 30 million words, in truth, really what we're trying to do is impact parent-child interaction at multiple levels. So we looked at the Parcheesi. Again, small ends in post-intervention. But what you can see in terms of positive behaviors, at baseline, we're pretty similar. And then post-intervention, you can see those in the TMW group are having more positive behaviors. How about negative behaviors? In the same way, but in reverse, you can see at baseline, those in the TMW and control group are pretty similar. Post-intervention, you can see those in the TMW group have significantly less negative behaviors. How about affect? Affects such as warmth, smiling, laughing, versus negative affects, rejection, frowning, or cold or harsh tone. We coded the videos for this as well and found similar impacts. in terms of positive affect. We were able to show at baseline, again, they start off quite similarly, and post-intervention, it appears for now that those in the TMW group have significantly more positive affect. Because we know attachment and maternal responsiveness is much more than just words. So this is a critical factor. How about negative affect? Same way. At baseline, very similar. In post-intervention, those in the experiment in the TMW group have significantly less negative affect. How about language input? Again, we are so... our ends are pretty small because the coding and then the morphology coding takes about 1,000 years, but I'll show you what we do have. As many of you all know, tokens are the number of words a parent uses. Type is the number of different words. And you'd hope that you could impact the type and the token, but especially the type. And what you can see here is at baseline, in terms of the number of overall words, they start off fairly similar, TMW versus control group. And after intervention, those in the TMW group have significantly more number of words. Not different words, but just number of words. How about types? This was sort of surprising to me. And again, look at the number of families that we have in both groups. It's minuscule. I'm sure it'll change, but I wanted to share some data. In terms of the number of different words, at baseline, they were quite similar. And what was interesting is after intervention, the TMW group basically stayed the same. But the control group went down. Not sure what to make of it. But what's interesting is, yeah, so we will continue to collect data. How about conversations? Dr. Romeo's article really shows the importance of conversations at home. And we'll show you a little bit of the impacts on conversational turns. Now, this is the control group, as you remember, looking at baseline, post-intervention, and then 7 months post-intervention. Can anybody guess why there's an upward trend in the number of conversations in the control group? Take a guess. Yeah, they're getting older. There's a natural. And so this is just an example of why you need randomized control trials. It'd be super easy to do this study and say, hey, I'm really helping, whereas it's just the natural aging process. So how about the experimental group? So what's very interesting, and again, we continue to collect data, is that we significantly impact conversations during the intervention and after intervention, although you can see the last data point is coming closer. What does this mean? I don't know. Does it mean that those conversations during those early years are critically important, and there's only a threshold, there's only so many conversations you can have with a child? I don't know. This is why we continue to collect the data, but this is the data. This is going to have probably 3 lifetimes of data, so we have a lot of work ahead of us in data collection. We hope to, you know, most importantly, not only demonstrate sustained impact on families' knowledge and behaviors with their children, but importantly, impacts on child outcomes, school readiness, math and spatial ability. I'm sure there will be many roadblocks and many things that do work, many things that don't work. But importantly, the science is going to help us understand what works and what doesn't so that we can impact what doesn't. Now, I want to share a little bit about our Well Baby initiative as well. It's a really fun and exciting study because I think the healthcare system is just ripe for really impacting this as an issue. As I said, not everybody goes into childcare, but almost everyone sees their healthcare practitioner. You could ask, why did we develop basically a video-based intervention in the healthcare system that has pediatricians and nurses part of the process, but not the main. We actually did a lot of formative testing, meeting with pediatricians and healthcare providers, and they all said, you know what, this is really, really great. We believe in this, but if you give us one more intervention to work to do it in our clinics, we're going to fall over. And so we heeded that. There are a number of people who do work in the pediatrics clinics, Alan Mendelson with VIP, Reach Out and Read, which are incredibly effective. We chose to take the lighter dose approach, and I really view these as not mutually exclusive, but to be layered upon. So our video-based bilingual intervention, as I mentioned, works at the 1, 2, 4, and 6 month visit. We're in the midst of an RCT that initially was 500. We went to 450. Our Hispanic population, it was a little bit more difficult to recruit towards the end because of changing socio-political status in this country. But anyways, I will share with you the data. What's very exciting about this is that the intervention works in the first 6 months, but we're following children until the age of 2, maybe even longer. As you can see, in the control group, they get either safety videos or usual care. And we're looking at both maternal outcomes as well as child outcomes. I'll share with you what we have thus far. The majority are high school or less. The majority are unemployed. And single parents in the English-speaking and non-single parents in the Spanish-speaking population. So let's just look at some of the outcomes. You're familiar with the speak. We have actually different versions of the speak, but we use the 10-item version for the clinic. But you can see in the English speaking that we're able to impact knowledge at 6 months and 7 months with this intervention in the English speaking group, as well as the Spanish speaking group. So both groups took in the knowledge from the videos and retained it. Now, how about behaviors? Can you impact behaviors with such a light touch intervention? Frankly, I was pretty skeptical, and I'm still skeptical, but that's the role of a scientist. Towards that end, we decided to use something called the NCAST as a measure. How many of you all have heard of the NCAST? It's basically a really short video. We had to get something short because it was in the clinic. You know, 450 families in a clinic room, you have to be, you know, pretty efficient. So it's a 10-minute video that you code for a number of different things. The NCAST is a much larger domain than we were interested in, but we coded for everything and then prospectively defined the items that we were interested in analyzing that we thought would be responsive to our intervention. And again, this is only the English-speaking population. But overall, in the NCAST, we were able to, again, it's still early, to be able to show significant impacts. Now, whether or not they're clinically relevant, I can't tell you yet, but significant impacts on maternal linguistic behavior overall. We looked at the sample items related to praise and encouragement. Again, significant impacts there, as well as on maternal use of complex language. We defined these going into the study. How about child vocabulary measures? We use something called the MacArthur-Bates, which is a caregiver report of child language skills. It's not directly observed, but parents fill out this report. And we looked at both 9 and 12 months, and we found some interesting things. In our English-speaking population, we showed no impact. But interestingly, in our Spanish-speaking population, we showed impact on both expressive and receptive. At 12 months, again, no real significant impacts on English speaking. But on our Spanish speaking, once again, we were able to demonstrate, and again, we're still very much in the data collection phase, looking like there's impact on the receptive. The expressive, believe it or not, is not a significant difference, even though visibly it looks like it. We continue to collect the data on our well baby, so hopefully we'll be able to share that in the next year, looking at impacts up until the age of two, and really thinking about, you know, our next steps are not just following these families, but really figuring out how can we connect the newborn to well baby and start that continuum. And with that, I'm going to end actually with a video that has nothing to do with the actual interventions. It really brings me back to what it's all about. Because it's really easy when you talk so top down, so high level about interventions, about science, about public health approaches, that we forget really where the power lies and where who the true architects of their children's brains are. It's the parents and caregivers of this country. And towards that end, I like to end off with Sammy, because he's a dad too, which is very cool, who shows us that not only can he impact his own child's life, but he can impact the community around him. So I will end it off with Sammy, because he says it much better than I.
I have a few friends that have young kids, and I've taught them the what I've learned at TMW, the tune in, talk more, and take turn concepts. My friend Tay came over with her daughter Shaniqua, and Shaniqua and Blake were both sitting on the floor playing with toys. Shaniqua had a Barbie in her hand, and I pretty much got down on the floor and tuned in to what Shaniqua was doing. And my friend Tay asked me, like, Sammy, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm tuning in to what she's doing, and she wanted to know more about it. I told my friend Sarah in Indianapolis about it. She has a 2-year-old son. I told my friend in Atlanta, Georgia, Chiquita, about it. She has a 2-year-old daughter. When I see my friends doing some of the things that I taught them, and just to know that they're going to teach it to their kids and their kids going to grow up and teach it to their kids is all a big accomplishment.
You want to have a good relationship where your kids will always want to talk to you, and what better way to start but to talk to them?
The benefit of telling people about the program, that everybody's kid will have a jump start when they go into preschool or go into first grade, and their test scores will be up, and we won't have to worry about no kid left behind, because there won't be a kid left behind.
I think spreading the words about TMW is important, because if I tell one friend, and that one friend is going to tell another friend, then that one friend is going to tell a group of people, which is kind of like the domino effect, and we'll have a world full of smart babies running around.
And that's what it's all about, because our science is in service of Sammy. So I want to thank you all for listening.
Hi, thank you for your great talk, Jessica Kramer, Department of Occupational Therapy. I have some partners in public health from Brandeis, and we've been tackling this issue around child development and the 0-3 issue, and we're looking at the intersection with disability. So I'm but taking a public health approach, or a health for all approach, including children with disabilities. So I'm wondering if you've envisioned the intersection between this and children who have significant developmental disabilities, or children who are hearing impaired or deaf and who choose not to get or don't get cochlear implants, and what that might translate to. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. So the thing that I learned that really brought me to this is that while I always, you know, like Sting says, while our ideology may be different, our biology isn't. And what's amazing is that it's really, at the end of the day, the power of interaction and language. Again, language, whether it's spoken, whether it's sign, that builds a child's brain. So elevating this idea is not just elevating it for a specific population. It's for everyone. So it's absolutely inclusive. I mean, I come from the world of hearing loss, and unlike many surgeons, I'm not anti-sign. I am pro-language. So towards that end, you know, we We are a small lab, although we're growing. And even though we look like we're a very large force, we're a very small force. So yes, I hope that that this is not just about me doing everything. It's about all of us doing everything. So I would love to join you in what you're going to do.
Can you talk a little bit about the challenges that you foresee with this new project to scale up to the community level? What kinds of things do you anticipate being difficult?
Where do you start? I mean, what's fascinating is that at every step of this journey is an opportunity for learning. And one of the most fascinating things is that we all put so much faith in this thing called the randomized control trial. Oh, we did a randomized control trial with this impact. Let's scale it up. And in truth, there are so many different projects that have impact in a well-controlled trial, or even two or three. But then when you scale, I always say that they need a journal called JNR, the Journal of Null Effects, because most interventions that scale don't have impact. And that's why it's very exciting. That's why this partnership with the community is not like, oh, let's plug and play. Let's see if it works. It's really a continuous learning. And my partner, John List, who's an economist, is really, he's now much more focused. He's focusing on this idea of the science of scaling and the barriers that occur that prevent these small scale effects from translating on the large scale, whether it be the issues of the situation or the issues of implementation, or I mean they're millions. And so but that's part of the fun, right? I mean, if it were easy, you know, it'd be boring. So they're going to be, I would say the issues of scaling are a huge issue. I mean, it's about partnership. There are many different, I don't know. Did that scare you enough?
Let's thank Dr. Suskin one more.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by University of Chicago Professor of Surgery, Dr. Dana Suskin. Dr. Suskin's lecture was titled 30 Million Words, A Public Health Approach to Early Childhood Education, and was presented by the Boston University College of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences, Sargent College. Tonight's moderator was Sargent College Dean Christopher Moore. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Matt Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.